Welcome everyone to the last show of the year, I believe. I get the date wrong a lot these days, but I think it's the 31st.
You're back.
It's Monday, right? And we don't have a show tomorrow, unfortunately, which people have been hammering into my brain. But I'm here and you're here.
Yes, hi, I'm so glad to be here. It's so weird because it's the last show of the year, but not the last show of the week. It's like,
yeah, it's weird.
You're like,
we get a day off.
Yeah.
And you're gonna be around the rest of the week as well, because we're gonna have some people out of town.
Yeah, I'm gonna be behind the scenes. Sweating, it's fine.
Yes, but it's gonna be not only a good week, but also a good day. We've got two guests who are gonna be joining us a little bit later on. One familiar face, one new face, although probably someone you're familiar with. We've got Ken Klippenstein, he's gonna be joining us. We're gonna talk about a little bit of the reporting that he did through the course of 2018, preview some of what he's going to be working on. And I've got a few questions about the role of an investigative reporter like him, both with some of the stories he's been sort of reporting on ongoing, like we're gonna talk about Yemen and all that, but also with the Democratic primary gearing up already, as we'll get into in the news section of the show.
Yeah, big news today.
Exactly, what role he can play in that area. But we also have, speaking of presidential contenders, we have Richard Ojeda, who's going to be joining the show. We're gonna be talking about his candidacy because he was, I believe, the first to announce. So we're gonna be talking about what he thinks the primary campaign on the Democratic side should be focused on. Probably comment on Elizabeth Warren's announcement as well. So a very exciting interview coming up in that regard. We do have some news for you as well. Elizabeth Warren announcing she's gonna be running for the presidency. Updated sources from inside the White House about how isolated Donald Trump is apparently feeling going into the new year. A preview of what we can expect there going into 2019. And later on, Louis C.K. has popped back up. Some leaked audio from one of his sets. We're gonna talk about that. It's something you're passionate about.
I just think, you know, he's just bad.
Well, hold on.
You know, sorry.
I want them to, that's at the end of the show.
Okay.
You have to listen to the end of the show.
Right, okay.
Okay, end of the hour.
I just wanted to clarify, I don't know if passionate is the word.
Well, I feel like we've been talking about it for 3 years now.
That's Brett's fault.
Yes, Brett was talking about it a lot. Okay, we'll see if we can get him to join us.
It's totally my fault.
But anyway, lots to get to, why don't we jump into the news.
Okay.
Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has announced, not that she's running for president really, but she has an exploratory committee. She's running.
Right.
She's running. She changed her Twitter handle, which is, I think, the official thing that you do. It's like switching over to in a relationship.
Yeah.
So now she is E. Warren as opposed to Elizabeth 4MA, which confused people.
I mean, I think the DNA test was like, you know, the biggest announcement that she's running. Mm-hmm. At least it just backfired.
We're gonna talk about that.
Oh, are we?
We're gonna talk about that. But this news this morning came about. There was both tweets and some video sections. Let's go through those. She tweeted, "Every person in America should be able to work hard, play by the same set of rules, and take care of themselves and the people they love. That's what I'm fighting for, and that's why I'm launching an exploratory committee for president. I need you with me, ElizabethWarren.com." I just think it's so funny, an exploratory committee.
Yeah.
Because she's gonna start thinking about it. She hasn't been thinking about it, she's gonna start now with the new committee. Anyway, she has an ad, it's getting pretty good reviews. Some of the stuff that she's choosing to focus on, we have a few sections for you, here's the first.
We got a real opportunity to build something. Working families today face a lot tougher path than my family did. And families of color face a path that is steeper and rockier, a path made even harder by the impact of generations of discrimination. I've spent my career getting to the bottom of why America's promise works for some families, but others who work just as hard slip through the cracks into disaster.
Okay, so you see there in this first ad, I mean, generally in a policy sense, it's focused on income inequality. We're gonna get into in a later section some of who is leading to these issues economically. But there was a thick vein of acknowledging the racial discrimination aspect of income inequality in the economic situation. What did you think?
You know, what I thought, I saw a lot of reaction to this early this morning, and I think, there's a question. And so, yes, I think these are things that you want people to talk about, especially like, you know, as a woman of color, my, you know, in America. But is it, it's hard to defend it that it's not like pandering when, you know, she spent so long almost like refusing to listen to a huge group of Native Americans who are also people of color, just ignoring, you know, them saying, hey, this hurts, hey, this is offensive. And she kind of like leaned in it. And I know you're like, we'll get to that. But so
no,
then
right
it just
now.
Seems
Is it possible that she has a blind spot on that particular issue because she's been attacked on it for so many years?
But maybe has a better. Has she been?
I mean, Donald Trump has been tweeting about it for years.
Right, you're right.
And spreading misinformation about the extent to which she identified in that way. I think that she, I agree with you, I think that she made it worse for herself in the most recent go round. But it was in the news constantly, not because she kept talking about it, but because Donald Trump and some of his lackeys kept talking about it.
But like, what's more important, like fighting back against someone who offends everybody or the people who you need to vote for you and who you're gonna put out an ad and say, hey, I'm fighting for you, I care about you, I hear you. I think it's probably better to actually listen.
I agree, but it's also possible you could do both. You could be wrong on this aspect and tone deaf and not really understand what you're launching yourself into, while in other areas acknowledging this issue.
Or it's like, well, there's a thin line between like acknowledging the issue and just kind of like using it to sell a presidential campaign.
It is, yes, I agree. And look, there's gonna be a million candidates in the Democratic side. We're gonna have to be on the lookout for that. I would say that in terms of the economic issues, she has a pretty good track record. I mean, back in 2007, she wrote a letter initially calling for a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She eventually, was nominated to be the head of that. On these issues, I think that she's been pretty awesome. And so I think that she has the background, not just the positions on the issues, but years and years of advocacy on the issues to back up. Like there are candidates who could come out with this ad today and it would be like, well, come on. I mean, you've had opportunities. And I think we might eventually see those from Joe Biden. But I'm kidding.
Oh my gosh.
I'm kidding. I can't wait to see his first ads. But I'm saying I think that she can back it up with not only the positions that she holds now, but in the past as well. And let's just put it out there. We're gonna go to more of her ad. I mean, obviously she's for Medicare for all. I think that she's good on the environmental issues. Regulation of Wall Street, obviously she's a champion on that issue as well. We can start to get into exactly who's more progressive on particular issues, but we've profiled some big ideas in terms of drug pricing, a few other, her anti-corruption bill that she's pushing forward for the new year. She's got some big, bold ideas, I think, which is necessary.
Okay, so I have a question for you. So maybe we can agree that this is not the worst thing for someone to do, but is this necessary? I think
is it necessary?
Warren running for president?
I don't understand your position. I don't understand it. I don't understand what you're saying.
Feel you do.
No, I really don't. Elizabeth Warren is. Are we really down to 30 seconds? Okay, Elizabeth Warren's a senator, so she's one statewide office. Like that's a difficult thing. And it's not like Massachusetts, some rando tiny little town.
Right.
Or state. That's a big one. If you could do that, that's that's a potential hurdle.
It's definitely a tiny little state, but it's an important
Massachusetts,
state.
I'd say it's a big one.
Like physically.
Okay, well I think it's important. Anyway,
no, you're right.
So she has one. Silly. She's not like a person who pops up and it's like, hey, I've got a website that looks like it was made on GeoCities and I went to a rally 7 years ago. Like she has one elected office. She's maintained a high profile amongst a crowded field for literally years. She's an advocate on the issues we care about. I don't understand why you think it's a sideshow.
But with all of that, one could really say, like, do we need this? Nah.
As opposed to who? I mean, obviously she's not my number one pick right now, but why do you believe that she can't win?
Do you believe that she will?
I think that she's polling worse than a number of other candidates, Bernie Sanders, Biden, Beto probably now at this point, although we'll see in 6 months.
Right.
But I think that she has every bit as good of a chance as a number of other people that are bandied about, Gillibrand and Booker and Harris. I think that she polls generally around them.
Okay.
So it's possible.
No, I'm learning.
What is it about her that makes you think that she can't do it?
I don't know if I don't feel like just in general that she can't do it, I think. But in this race, I just don't see it happening.
Okay. Well, I know that we're over. I want to play the second set of the video, brief reaction. Here's more from our ad.
How do we get here? Billionaires and big corporations decided they wanted more of the pie. And they enlisted politicians to cut them a fatter slice. They crippled unions so no one could stop
them. We're going to turn the bull loose.
Dismantled the financial rules meant to keep us safe after the Great Depression and cut their own taxes so they paid less than their secretaries and janitors.
It's time to write the rules for the middle class.
After Wall Street crashed our economy in 2008, I left the classroom to go to Washington and confront the broken system head on.
Elizabeth Warren, apparently not afraid to tangle with Wall Street.
Elizabeth Warren is heading into the lion's den.
Mrs. Warren goes to Washington.
So I think that's pretty good.
No, I think that will be very appealing. Ad, for sure. I do.
Okay.
I think this is fantastic.
It's a great ad for the sideshow that is her
candidacy. You used that word. I have never used that. I just I think she's kind of crossed the line that I don't see her being able to recover from.
Okay. Well, you might be right. That did shake people's confidence. I think she should be considered one of the top tier competitors.
Not only
she's
did
not my
it
number
shake
one,
people's
but
confidence in her, I think that it made it very clear like where she stands mm-hmm. on certain issues. I don't know if it was just it just shook your confidence in her, if it just kind of like opened your eyes to maybe, you know, who she is and where she stands.
Maybe. I don't know. I think nobody's perfect. Everybody does some embarrassing
that
stuff.
Is
obviously,
true.
I am not immune to that. So look, I have a feeling we're going to be talking more about Elizabeth Warren through the course of this year.
Yeah.
Since the election is in, I think, 670 something days. Can we just point out, Jesus Christ, people are running
never
early.
Never say that again.
It's right. So far. It is 13 months until the Iowa caucuses. Okay. So, but look, there are other candidacies. In fact, we're going to be joined in this next block by Richard Urgetta, who's also
the president's
candidate.
Been running since the day after inauguration. So
that's true.
It's not like it's too early.
That's true. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Richard Urgetta will join us. We'll talk about his candidacy, what he thinks this primary season should be focused on issues-wise after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
On the topic of those running for president, I'm very excited to welcome to the show our next guest, Richard Urgetta, who you're probably very familiar with, current state senator, retired from the Army. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So look, obviously we're already in the primary season, historically very early to be in it. You were either the first or one of the first to officially announce. We're going to get into that strategy-wise, but I want to focus first on the issues. Every candidate is going to be fighting to make this primary season about a certain issue or set of issues. For the good of both your campaign, but more importantly for the country, what do you think this primary season needs to be focused on issues-wise?
Issues-wise, you know, I think that the opioid epidemic is something that we must address. We've got to address jobs in this country. And, you know, we also have to, when we're talking about jobs, it's also about having a vision for the jobs of the future. You know, we can't fight the fact that technology, you know, takes out a lot of, you know, today's, working class citizens' capabilities. But we've got to realize that, you know, we have to look at that, accept that, and then start trying to figure out how we can be able to keep people employed in the future. And that's one of the things that I think is very important. And, but I also want to go ahead and throw this in there too. Global warming. Okay, I'm just going to let you know, I might be from West Virginia, but I do know that global warming does exist. I support the Green New Deal, and I want it to take hold as soon as possible, because we need to bring those jobs to places like West Virginia, Kentucky, Michigan, places that are struggling with jobs, so that these people, that if they are in the mining, you know, side of the house, they can start transitioning now so they can feed their family. We can't wait until someone pulls the plug on this industry before we start looking at doing something about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I'm very glad that you brought it up first, actually. I do want to talk about opioids, though, because during the last election, there were a couple of questions during the debates about opioids, and it was like, oh my God, people are actually talking about it. Maybe there will be some progress. Even Trump was saying, what's that?
It's about time.
Exactly. And even Trump was saying that he's going to address this issue. And he's underfunded it. He's taken apart some of the organizations inside of government that were dealing with it. We seem to have backtracked on the issue. If you become president, what would you like to see happen to finally address this epidemic?
Well, we've never addressed Big Pharma. It's time to check Big Pharma. You know, they've come in, they've thrown their oxycodone and hydrocodone on our people like Tic Tacs. We lost more people last year than all the lives lost during the Vietnam War. The only reason why that continues to go on is because the lobbyists for Big Pharma go into our capitals and they grease the pockets of legislators who are all too quick to roll over for those people because they're just looking at their next job when they're done being a congressman or a senator. Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. We've got to stop allowing that stuff to happen.
I agree. And I have a feeling that this Democratic primary, there's going to be a lot of focus on how candidates fund their campaigns. I know that part of the Green New Deal committee is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would like them not to accept any money from the oil and gas industries. What do you think in terms of funding a candidate who wants to represent the Democratic Party needs to have?
I think that, you know, I think it's Seattle that just recently did a program where every citizen was given a voucher for $125. Mm-hmm. And each citizen, when they got that voucher, could give it to any person that they wanted in terms of, you know, running for office. And they would be allowed to match that themselves. So that's $250 per person. I think that we could do that with everything, do that with corporate PACs, do that with every type of organization out there that donates to campaigns. Let's get big money out of politics. Let's overturn Citizens United, and let's finally start giving people an even playing field.
I would love to have a situation where a corporation had the exact same amount of money as any one random American to fund politics.
Absolutely. No, money is not free speech.
I agree. So, okay, you obviously have launched your candidacy pretty early historically, although now we have Elizabeth Warren today. Strategically, what made you decide to throw your hat in the ring so early?
Well, number one, we realize that the problems that we face here where I ran for Congress are the same problems we face everywhere. We also know that in January, which of course today started, you know, with Elizabeth Warren, those people that throw their hat in the ring, the Cory Bookers, you know, the Beto O'Rourke's, the people like that, they're going to completely drown out the media from someone like myself. And that's another reason why we went ahead and jumped in this race early. And it really benefited us because, you know, we've been on Morning Joe. I've sat down with Jake Tapper, Chuck Todd, and obviously, you know, the Young Turks has been very, friendly to me and my campaign. And I really appreciate that. But, you know, that's part of it. But also a person like myself that doesn't have the backing, the financial backing that they have. It's going to take me to be out there putting boots on the ground everywhere across this country, meeting as many people as possible and hearing their issues so that I can be able to compete. So that when we do get on that debate stage in June in Iowa, I got things that I got to say.
Exactly. And there is a chance that there's going to be a lot of people on that debate stage, although the DNC has recently announced that they're going to be requiring a great deal of grassroots fundraising to get one of those spots. On the topic of the DNC, obviously, they were criticized. There you go. They were criticized a lot the last go around for putting their thumb on the scale. I think it would be one way to put it pretty lightly. What would you like to see out of the DNC for this primary season?
They need to give everybody an equal shot. You know, it should not be about who makes the most money or who has the most money. You know, once again, you know, it seems like if there's two people that are running for office, the first question that comes out of their mouth is who's got the most money? And whoever that is, that's who they go with. There's a reason why we've lost over 1,000 seats across this country, because they're not focused on who can win the race and who relates to the people. Yeah. That's what we need to do. I'm going to tell you, those people out there, the Elizabeth Warrens, the Cory Bookers, the Kamala Harris, those people, they do have a lot of opportunities to get media following them. But that doesn't mean that they are better. First off, I look at that. They've been in politics for quite some time. They've been there while we've been in decline. And what have they done to elevate us? Very little. And I'm telling you right now, I think that it's time for us to have a change. And there's no reason why a person like myself shouldn't get that opportunity. If you look at the levels of responsibility that I have held in my military career, you know, if I didn't do my job, people didn't come home. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's far more in terms of the level of responsibility, far higher than some of the things that these people deal with.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, we've got to find somebody who can turn Republicans back to the Democratic Party, turn Trump voters back to the Democratic Party. Out of all the races in Congress, I was number one. I turned 36.5 points back to the Democratic Party. If we can't figure or find somebody who can do that, then get ready to start crying again in 2020.
I would prefer not to. So let's stay on that. Probably it's going to have to be the last question, unfortunately. But on the issue of Trump, you know, whoever is the nominee is going to have to go against him. If there's anything he relishes in politics, it's attacking those on the other side. So how do you see yourself like counterpunching against Donald Trump while also attempting to, you know, get a healthy chunk of his voters to switch over to you?
I think I've already proven that I can do that. I've proven I'm the guy that stands with the working class. Donald Trump talks about helping the working class, but he doesn't. The very people that he stands in front of and acts like he's for them couldn't even afford to play one round of golf at any of his fancy country clubs out there. Believe me, I have no problems fighting this guy where he stands. And I'm not scared to say the things that most people are scared to say. I'm the one that's actually going to go out there and be as open as possible. I'm the one that's calling for lobbyists to wear body cameras. You know, I'm the guy that has no problem going toe to toe with this guy. And let me tell you something, you know, I don't sugarcoat nothing.
Well, that's pretty clear. So, Richard, thank you for joining us. Hopefully, we'll have you back on, you know, a little bit further into the primary season. Like you pointed out, it might be difficult sometimes with the number of candidates to get on some of the bigger shows. They're a little bit biased in who they let on. But on the Young Turks, there's always going to be a spot.
Hey, I appreciate that. You guys are awesome. The Young Turks, you guys have always been great to me. And thank you for your support.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, let's see. Yemen, not only is the situation deteriorating there, but we now have reports that child soldiers are being used. We're going to break that down after this. Welcome back, everybody. So much to get to. I'm just going to jump right into it. As we prepare to enter 2019, new reports coming out of the White House, Donald Trump is apparently feeling the pressure. And maybe just on a subconscious level, apparently understanding the political situation that he's about to enter into. Fundamentally different than the 2 years that has already passed, because there will be a Democratic House majority. So let's go through this a little bit, both so that we can understand the state of mind of the person who's going to be, you know, issuing executive orders and all that, but also because he's apparently feeling some anxiety, and so there'll be some schadenfreude there for us. Let's see. At the midpoint of his term, Mr. Trump has grown more sure of his own judgment and more cut off from anyone else's than at any point since taking office, which we have to acknowledge for Donald Trump is something. He spends ever more time in front of a television, often retreating to his residence out of concern that he is being watched too closely. So understand, the only people who could really be watching him are generally his aides and people working for him. But one of the lines through all these reports that are coming out, and apparently they talked to, New York Times talked to 30 current and former aides and officials, friends, all of that, is that he doesn't even trust his inner circle anymore. Even Jared and Ivanka, like he likes them, he has a hard time saying no to them, but he doesn't agree with their judgment anymore. So he was having Kelly tell them no on things, but now Kelly's out. So I don't know, just the inner family workings in the White House, I don't understand how that's going to work going forward.
This is also not shocking. I think it's interesting to have it like broken down and hear that he, you know, is like aggressively just not getting along with the people who are kind of supposed to be on his side.
The people that he's chosen.
But it's not a shock though, because like the turnover rate in this administration is actually worse than the mall after Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad.
It's like 63%, I think.
It's
exactly.
So
yeah, and so look, I read that quote because, you know, it feels good that he's embattled and all that. But also understand, if he's not talking to his advisors, if he's not talking to his aides, if he believes that he already knows everything and all he's listening to is Fox News, that is going to have an effect on policy, both in terms of the types of laws that they try to pass, probably unsuccessfully now that there will be a Democratic House majority, but also, does he pursue new executive orders?
Also, right, and it's like throw it out the window that the idea of him listening to a Democrat, got it. Someone mm-hmm. who like just opposes everything about him, got it. But we're talking about people who are on his side, people who, and the idea that they have reached their limit to where they can't just be, you know, yes people.
Yeah.
They have to say, okay, this is actually not going to work. Actually, you can't do this. This is not a thing.
Yeah.
This is not legal. This doesn't make any sense.
He doesn't like it.
And partially, I don't even think, you know, their job, they're not necessarily doing this, you know, for the good of the country as much as like they have to protect him. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't like it when you disagree, even if you're making sense. And so what's the point of having aides?
Yeah.
If he doesn't you don't have think, people who, right.
He didn't want to have a chief of staff.
Right, so.
He felt he should be his own. This is a help me, help you situation, and he won't let them.
And he is his own, essentially.
Let's read some more of this. Okay. The president has told associates he feels, quote, totally and completely abandoned, as one put it, complaining that no one is on his side and that many around him have ulterior motives, which certainly seems to be the case. Always impulsive, the president increasingly believes he does not need advisors, according to people close to him. Let's double down on the TV angle of this, though.
Yeah.
Mr. Trump's consumption of cable television has actually increased in recent months, as his first scheduled meetings of the day have slid back from 9 or 9:30 to roughly 11 o'clock many mornings. During executive time, Trump watches television in the residence for hours, reacting to what he sees on Fox News, which is the way you would talk about an infant holding an iPad, by the way. But that is our president. And even when he finally goes into his meetings in the West Wing, he leaves on the TV, keeping an earbud in, apparently one ear attuned. And so he's only paying half attention to the few hours a day of presidenting that he really does.
Presidenting, right. I mean, to whom much is given, much is required. And I believe mm-hmm. that. And the president of the United States starts work at 11 a.m. Like, stop.
Imagine if you found out that we start work at 11. You'd be like, I mean, come on, you gotta, like, isn't YouTube a grind? You've really gotta work. He's the president.
The president.
And he's watching TV till 11. I loved back when I had a lifestyle where mm-hmm. I could wake up and play video games before doing stuff. Even I would check out before 11 to get my life in order.
Right.
Not on the weekends, though. Okay, so a little bit more. Mr. Trump is said by advisors to be consumed by the multiplying investigations that have taken down his lawyer, campaign chairman, national security advisor, and family foundation. He rails against enemies who often were once friends, nursing a deep sense of betrayal and grievance as they turn on him. And so there's two angles to this. One is, this investigation is taking a toll on him, obviously. Mm-hmm. It would not
no
take this
what
sort
he
of
says.
Toll. Exactly. And it wouldn't take this sort of toll were he, if he could look to the future and say, they're not gonna have anything on me because I'm innocent, you would not be falling apart as a result of the investigation. But secondly, he doesn't have the psychological makeup for this sort of high profile, high stress situation. He can maybe do it on TV. He can do a few seasons of a TV show. But as president, even his closest advisors, people who are lackeys for him, he feels betrayed by them.
Just simply because they don't agree.
Exactly.
Which is.
And these are people who, although I will disagree with them on almost every issue,
right.
probably know more about the issues and know more about, obviously they're not gonna be working towards sorts of goals that I would set, but they can help him to achieve his goals. But he undercuts himself constantly. I mean, he did that in advance of the midterm elections where he could have hyped up the what seemed like, at least on a surface level, good economic news. Instead, he made it about a caravan, which is a divisive issue, obviously, and turned out some people against him. He announced the pullout of Syria, which a lot of Republicans were not in favor of, when he could have been talking again about the positive economic news at that point. He attacked a bunch of the big corporations and helped in advance of Christmas. The stock market tanked as a result of his direct intervention. These are things where he has gone above and beyond to undercut and sabotage his own ability to achieve his goals at every step of the way.
But you made a good point, you know, that it just hit me when you talked about the caravan, because it actually, and if you look at it, go with me here, he's right. Because think about it, the only thing that he really cares about is likability, his, mm-hmm. His fans. They love this stuff. They don't, over and over, they've been shown, he said this, it doesn't make sense. He said this, it's not right. He said this, it's not gonna happen. He said this, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And nobody cares. They don't care. And the caravan thing, that worked. That kind of pushed people
with
to the polls.
Base.
It
yeah.
worked, exactly. And so I imagine that there was somebody that said, hey, this is a little racist. I just hope there was one person who was mm-hmm. maybe not. But these things work, you know, kind of how he leaned in during, you know, when Kavanaugh was kind of having to answer to these horrible allegations. Mm-hmm. It worked.
Yes, I agree with that.
I think it's hard. You know, you've got to battle against the fact that, like, he's got a lot of fans and voters who don't care mm-hmm. and who like this wild stuff that really a lot of it hurts them and the country in the end.
The question is that enough to win re-election?
I think it's the only thing that it could do.
Yeah, maybe. I doubt he's suddenly going to become reasonable. But I want to read one more section from this because it's pretty sad. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to agree. More recently, so I'm jumping ahead here, by the way. More recently, Mr. Trump has taken to spending time reminiscing about the happier days of his candidacy and his 2016 victory. He spent the fall showing different groups of visitors what he calls his love letters from North Korea's iron-fisted dictator, expressing admiration for Mr. Trump. And he still takes joy in aspects of the job, primarily those that demonstrate power. Quote, "The roads closed for me," he declared to friends this year after a motorcade ride. Again, the way that like Dudley from Harry Potter would talk.
Right,
that's
time.
Our president. And the thing is, honestly, like given the choice between him being out there and pushing for his horrendous agenda and, you know, dismantling, you know, executive offices, like all that stuff, if instead he's just reminiscing on 2016, I guess that does less damage to the country. And so if he retreats into the West Wing, into this shell, I think that that's really sad on one level, but it might be the best that we can hope for on another. Yeah. Okay, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Ken Klippenstein is going to be joining us from TYT Investigates after this. Joining us now to break down some of his 2018 reporting, give us a preview of what he'll be working on in 2019, TYT Investigates, Ken Klippenstein, back on the show. Ken, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Always glad to have you here. So a few things I want to talk about, some news, some of what you're going to be working on. But first, I do want to give you some credit. You've been on the show multiple times over the course of the year to profile different stories that you had worked on, investigations you had done. From your point of view, let's pat you on the back a little bit. What was some of the standout work that you did this year?
I was happy with the work on Saudi Arabia, and above all, happy that people are really starting to care about this issue now, because I've been covering Yemen since the Obama administration. It was really hard to get people to, you know, care about it then. And, you know, to the public's credit, they are getting a lot more involved now, particularly after the Khashoggi scandal. And I think we're going to see some real motion on that in the Congress this coming year.
Hopefully. I mean, we saw a couple of weeks ago big votes in the Senate, hopefully with Ro Khanna and his movement in the House. We won't have to wait much longer for some movement in the House as well. That would certainly be good. And yeah, I just want to say, I mean, especially on issues like Yemen, like I know from my personal experience, we talk about it a lot. When we put up videos on Yemen, people don't watch them. But when you do investigations and you like tweet them out, they get reach. And so it like warms my heart to see this in-depth important reporting on topics that people generally you have to twist their arm to get them to care about it. The fact that they're so excited to share what you have found, I just enjoy seeing that. So thank you for your work.
I appreciate that, because I try very hard to try to make it digestible and you know, something that ordinary people can follow. So because we've seen what happens when you just let the think tanks you know, follow these things. Not the best outcome.
No.
So I think it's important to try to translate in a way that public can not only understand, but feel like they can make a difference. And I do think we can on this. I've been in touch with a number of you know, Democrats' offices in the last few weeks, and we're going to see real motion on this, and there's going to be a real chance to change what is, you know, really a disgusting humanitarian you know, crisis that was completely voluntary, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk about a new way we've discovered over the past few days that it is disgusting, and that is that apparently the Saudis have been using their money to fly in Sudanese mercenaries, including children as young as 14 to 17 years old, who apparently primarily go for the money. Is obviously awful. It's in the context of a situation, it's one of the worst foreign policy situations in the world right now. But how did you react to seeing that reporting from the New York Times?
Well, it was astonishing. And, you know, I wasn't shocked, because there had been reporting in smaller outlets. But what I was surprised by was that this was broken in the New York Times, which again is a reflection of the sea change in attitude, you know, towards not just Saudi Arabia, but the, you know, coalition war that we are supporting with tax dollars. It was shown that they weren't even charging the Saudi government for midair refuels of their sorties flying over to drop bombs in Yemen. So our tax dollars were actually paying for that, in violation of law, I believe, but also providing logistical and intelligence support without which the Saudis wouldn't be able to do this. You've had a number of serious, military analysts say they just don't have the kind of sophisticated military intelligence that you would need to carry out these kind of things without our critical support.
So can we get any kind of preview, anything you're working on right now in terms of Saudi Arabia and Yemen?
Yeah, I'm working on what is the next push to end U.S. participation in the war going to look like legislatively, because they came very close. But there are segments, of course, much of the Republican Party doesn't care. And there are segments of the Democratic Party that doesn't want to pull out of the coalition. So we're going to see a battle. It's not, it's not just because it was a close vote last time doesn't mean, it's a sure bet. And then also people are going to have to pressure the White House not to veto any kind of legislation that they pass. So there's a lot that's still up in the air, very fluid situation. And I, I'm really looking forward to keeping people informed of, how they can play some role in this. So again, we don't leave it to the think tanks who've so, brilliantly run the region for the last, decades.
So I want to change gears briefly. We are now, especially with Elizabeth Warren announcing her exploratory committee to possibly run for the presidency, I guess we're in the primary, 13 months out from the Iowa caucuses. So I know that you're focused right now on Yemen. Do you feel any pressure to begin investigations of any of these announced candidacies or any likely candidates?
This is sort of a reflection of my temperament. I tend not to, it's such a spectacle in some regard. I'm not saying it's not important. But the electoral spectacle can draw attention away from stuff that just like the Yemen thing we were talking about, people can make a real difference. So I'm gonna try my best to avoid that until it's like until I sense that it's a little more relevant. Because I mean, we just had the midterms and we're hardly talking about elections, And I mean, it's not like you shouldn't talk about it, but it's just like I'm an old fashioned like kind of gumshoe reporter. So I've never been. It's not that it's unimportant. It's just it hasn't always been my thing. So you'll definitely see stuff from me on the Democrats, but not yet.
Okay. And anything else you're working on right now?
I'm working on stuff with the shutdown. I will say this: I think the public would be amazed at in particular in Homeland Security relevant stuff is being shut down. Stuff that people desperately need and the services that are going to be shut down go far beyond what's been publicly reported.
Wow. And is it a situation where I'm assuming some of these organizations in the government probably have some operating funds that they can continue on? Is this a thing where, I mean, we're like 9-10 days in, is this going to get worse and worse as the weeks go on?
Absolutely, and it'll get much worse because some of these places still have discretionary funds. Really, what determines if they which agencies will continue running in large part is the agencies that still have money left over. What agencies are that? It's the Defense Department.
Yeah.
It's, aspects of the Department of Homeland Security. It's these things that people, might not think redound to their benefit a whole lot. On the other hand, what's going to get shut down? I mean, you see things, Social Security Administration. I had somebody from the IRS reach out to me saying, we help a lot of poor people. We help a lot of, folks that don't, have the resources to know how to fill out their taxes. We don't have resources to do that. And we're worried a lot of people aren't going to, be in complying with federal law because we literally don't have the resources to, show people how to do this stuff. So it goes way beyond what we know. And often the things that sort of help people, kind of socially the most kind of like benefit to the public are the ones that are running out of money.
Yeah. I have a feeling that if the IRS is unable to function this year, the Republican Party will be okay with that. Probably.
That's exactly what I've been saying. This is their platform, right? They want to shut down the government, not the Pentagon, not the Department of Homeland Security, but much of it, the stuff people that's really popular. They, so I wish it would be framed in that way.
Yeah, it's certainly an unequal playing field, sort of fundamentally in terms of a governing philosophy.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Ken, I want to thank you for joining us once again and helping close out the year on the Damage Report. Thank you for everything you do.
Thanks so much for always having me on. I've always appreciated the conversation.
Thank you. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, Louis C.K. has resurfaced in leaked audio. We're going to talk about it. Only a few minutes remaining. Let's talk about something that we'll agree on.
Okay.
Louis C.K. has popped back up in leaked audio of a new set, and he apparently is not really backing off of the controversial stuff. So we're gonna play some sections of it. This is again leaked audio posted on YouTube, and then we'll react. Here is the first section.
I don't know. They testify in front of Congress. These kids. Like, what the? What are you doing? You're young. You should be crazy. You should be unhinged. Not in a suit saying I'm here to tell you. You're not interesting. Because you went to a high school where kids got shot? Why does that mean I have to listen to you? How does that make you interesting? You didn't get shot. You pushed some fat kid in the way. And then, now I got to listen to you talking?
Okay, so that's a tough one. What was your reaction?
I mean, of course, my reaction is this is terrible. It's I guess it's on brand, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I think for him, even
person kind of box that he's been playing in.
Yeah, look. So I will say up front, for years, Louis C.K. was my favorite comedian. Mm-hmm. I've watched basically everything he's done for a couple of decades, so I understand the context.
And he does say, I watched a couple of his FX shows.
His show's really good. So here's the thing: I'm of the opinion that comedians can and should joke about literally everything.
Okay, and I'm absolutely
But they not. Can or cannot succeed at it. And I think that this is not there. I can imagine a world in which you could make a joke about the Parkland kids that was actually funny.
You can?
I guess. I wouldn't try to make it. And this wasn't really there. I know that Fred Guttenberg, who's a friend of the show, one of the Parkland parents, was not happy about this. I've seen other Parkland kids reacting really negatively. I would say you can try to joke about anything as a comedian, but you also have to choose your targets. And if you are doing a several minutes about this, then you're not doing it about other stuff. And so I would only do it if you really had nailed it. And I think this is kind of unnecessarily controversial. I don't think there's other stuff in this set, by the way, which I do think is funny. I don't think this really gets there. Although, again, I'm generally hands off when it comes to actual comedians, not political pundits who occasionally joke around and then try to use that as a cloak, like Jesse Waters or whatever. He's not a comedian, but Louis C.K. is a comedian. So I think, you know, marketplace of ideas and, you know, free capitalism for comedy, like if people want to go, they're going to go. But as a longtime Louis C.K. fan, I did not love this section.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess I don't know. I don't even understand why you would have the desire to even attempt to make something funny out of this. I don't know. That I think that just says I don't know.
You want to hear a little bit more?
Sure.
Okay. Here's the next section.
People get upset because they're young, right? They died so young. That's offensive to me. Because if I die now? F me. Everybody's gonna die. Why is it worse? I mean, old people die. Nobody gives a f. You know, like when you tell somebody my grandmother died, they're like, oh, how old was she? She was 98. Why'd you even tell me?
So here's the thing. If he was not talking about kids who had been killed in a massacre in schools, right, I would say this is what Louis C.K. does. He points out weird gaps in how we talk about things. And he's right. It should be as sad if a 98-year-old dies. But yeah, if you hear the 98-year-old dies, you're kind of like, well, yeah, they died. That's what they do.
I mean, that's just a cute way to look at it. He also like spews like racism and like homophobia. Like in it. Mm-hmm. But I guess because he's a comedian, like we can like dress it up and say that he points out. It's just a lot of like,
I'm not, by the way, in my defense of comedy, I'm not saying that anyone has to like it, obviously.
No, but for sure.
It is like there are books written about these topics that can have characters who believe bad things. I mean, to some extent, comedians are playing characters. Obviously, so I'm saying approach. I approach.
From what we know about him, is he playing a character?
I would say this is fairly real to who he is.
Probably my problem with this.
It is. I don't like some. And by the way, we're not going to be able to play all of it. There's other areas he gets into, like non-binary pronouns and things like that, in a way that I would say you're coming off as just an unnecessary old man. I would say it reminds me of some of the worst stuff that Jerry Seinfeld does, where I just don't understand why that is what you are choosing to focus your efforts on. It's just so particular to the comedian's own personal interests.
He's just like being himself.
But he is a comedian. It is an art form. It is a way to elicit truth.
He's also kind of a bad guy. So it's like, which title are we going with today? Mm-hmm. He's a comedian. He's kind of a bad person.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I would just say if I was Louis C.K. or if I was his publicist or if I was his PR manager and I was trying to evince a comeback, this is probably not how I would do it.
Right.
But then he's far, far more famous and wealthy than I am.
No, and it'll work because, you know, it'll work.
Yeah, we'll see. Anyway, there are other sections. You can find them. It's hard because it's comedy and people can choose to go or not go.
Yeah.
It's complex. Anyway, thank you for joining us. Always good to have you on. Thank you for watching. By the way, if you have not already rated the podcast, please do that. I love to read those reviews on iTunes. Hope to see some and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.